Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. I'm going to apologize right up front because I don't follow sports. I don't watch sports, and I'm usually not interested in sports, which means reading articles about concussion will inevitably lead to reading the names of well-known NFL and NHL players, who I haven't heard of, and so don't know how to pronounce their names. So I apologize and hope that it just cracks you up to hear this lady so badly mispronounce the names of famous guys. Our articles on concussion deal with the difficulty of diagnosis, personality changes related to brain trauma, and where things stand with the major sports leagues in the U.S. And we're going to start in the relationship realm. This was written for The Guardian by Lori Fox, published on April 24th, 2019, and titled, "Not Dead, But Gone: How a Concussion Changed My Girlfriend's Personality Forever." We have no place in our culture for this kind of grief. After her brain injury, Gabrielle was still there. It just wasn't the her I had loved. It's strange the way that in a crisis, your mind stops filming and starts taking Polaroids, essential snapshots of sound and color and light you can hold at arm's length afterward. There is the call from Gabrielle, her voice frantic, "I've been in an accident. Please come right now." There is me standing on the frozen street, staring at the car sprawled across two empty lanes, with the driver's side door crushed and hanging ajar like an unfinished thought. There is the blood and hair stuck to the inside of the window in the bitter, bitter January cold. There is a paramedic talking to me. There is red glass from busted tailgates strewn across the road, shimmering like hot coals as we get into the ambulance. There is Gabrielle on a stretcher with her neck in a brace and her lips pale and bloody. There is her hand slipping into mine, squeezing. In the hospital waiting room, a police officer explains to me that Gabrielle made an illegal left-hand turn and was struck by a vehicle traveling the same direction and that the driver could not possibly have stopped. She has a concussion, the doctor tells me as he uses a curved needle gleaming under the sterile lights of the emergency room to stitch her scalp up. I come home with Gabrielle leaning heavily against my side, and we wobble through the doorway of our apartment. In bed with the lamp turned down low, she sleeps, deeply, the way old dogs or sick children sleep, so solemnly and quietly you feel compelled to see they are still breathing. Stitches glisten black and damp and raw against her white scalp. I whisper in her ear, "I love you. You are safe. I will protect you no matter what." I turn off the light and cry quietly because the doctor said not to wake her. For the first few days after the accident, things were exactly as we were told they would be. Gabrielle suffered terrible headaches and nausea, worsened by external stimuli. Sound, light, strong odors, and motion. Gabrielle was unable to do more than lie on the bed or sit up in a chair. After a week, these initial symptoms began to abate, but other more complicated ones sprang up. Her body was healing, but something in her brain appeared to be malfunctioning. She was having difficulty expressing complex thoughts, which made her angry and confused. She would often stumble trying to explain her feelings, flailing for words, a burst into tears of anger when met with a task that used to be easy. She would snap at me and blame me for things that weren't my fault, like a broken cup, a malfunctioning printer, the phone ringing. Making choices caused her intense disorientation. Our first trip to the grocery store together, a week after the accident, selecting from the rows of products, as well as all the people, lights, and music, was too much sensory data for her to process. She shut her eyes and leaned against my chest. I had to take her back to the car and shop alone. When I returned, she was curled up against the window with her eyes closed, exhausted. Gabrielle had lost the intuition as to whether 10 minutes or 10 hours has passed. She would wake up 3 or 4 times in the night, irritable and anxious, because she was uncertain how much time had passed. The only thing that would help her get back to sleep was if I read to her, which often meant rereading the same few pages over and over because she did not remember what she had just heard. In this broken way, we enjoyed Andre Alexa's masterful 15 Dogs together. It took 2 months to finish it. I still cannot bear to look at a copy. We didn't know what was happening to Gabrielle or why while all of this was happening. All we knew for sure was that she was not like this before the accident and that the changes had to be related. It was only later through research that we came to understand the mechanics of the change. A concussion is, at a fundamental level, a bruised brain. Imagine you have a mason jar that is full of thick liquid and just big enough to accommodate a peach. If you shake the jar violently, the peach sustains multiple impact points. When you take the peach out, the bruised places are visible. If you cut into the bruise, you'll see the damage spreads beyond the area around the impact sites. In a peach, these bruises taste bad. In a brain, these neurons are now bad. They no longer function the way they should in the context of their neural network, interrupting and sometimes changing the flow of information, which regulates not only basic body functions, but the building blocks of who we are. This damage is thought to be largely irreversible. The doctors in the emergency room and in her single follow-up appointment told us Gabrielle's concussion was not severe. According to Paul Van Donkelaar, a professor at the University of British Columbia and specialist in the behavioral and psychological effects of brain injury, the severity of a concussion doesn't necessarily indicate how a person will be affected by it. "Just because the concussion is mild doesn't mean the outcome is mild," he told me. "This is partly because we don't fully understand just how far the damage spreads beyond the initial site of impact. Understanding of how the brain is damaged during a concussion is a rapidly evolving field of study," he said. "But unfortunately, many doctors, especially those in small towns like the one we lived in, often lack the specialized and updated training necessary to properly identify and treat concussions with the most up-to-date resources." Gabrielle and I knew none of this before her accident. We were sent home from the hospital with a single sheet of paper that read, "How to Care for Someone with a Concussion," at the top. I lived in a state of chronic exhaustion. I worked from home as the editor of a small weekly paper, a job which demanded consistent overtime. I often slipped out of bed after Gabrielle was asleep to edit copy or return emails. I was never off duty, either at the paper or for Gabrielle. I realize now I should have asked for help, but even if I had, I don't know to whom I would have appealed. Her parents lived on the other side of the country and did not speak English. Doctors often did not believe Gabrielle when she tried to tell them what was wrong with her. Our friends couldn't see the seriousness of the problem. Gabrielle could appear to be frustratingly normal for brief stretches of time, only to completely break down later when there was only me there to see these things. I felt that as long as I believed in her, she would get better. I began drinking heavily. I lost weight. I took caffeine tablets when I had to drive because I was so sleep deprived I worried it was unsafe. I often thought of leaving her. Once I even went so far as to pack my truck and drive out of town. I got outside the city limits and turned around. I felt that as long as I believed in her, she would get better. Then, 6 months after the accident, I went camping for 3 weeks without her. Gabrielle didn't want me to go, but I felt I had to start taking care of myself again. I was gone for less than 2 weeks when she cheated on me. She told me she'd met someone and had been unfaithful, very calmly. She was not calling to apologize. She was calling to ask if I would mind if she did it again. She said she had simply not been thinking about me. It was only cheating if she didn't tell me about it, she said. We were not in an open relationship. We'd been together for 2 years. I didn't yell. I didn't cry. I just kept asking over and over, how could you do this to me? I was stunned. The last time I'd come into town, she'd begged me to end my vacation early. She held on to her curious logic with childlike tenacity, warbling between emotionless repetition of her beliefs, it wasn't cheating, she had done nothing wrong, and angry outbursts. She accused me of not loving her, claiming I had only taken care of her to control her. She said over and over that she owed me nothing. She was half right. She didn't owe me anything, but I loved her more than I had loved my own health and happiness. At the time all this was happening, I was hurt so deeply, I was unable to see the familiar pattern, one I had observed countless times since her accident. Confronted with something emotionally and cognitively difficult, her behavior, my emotions, her breakup, she was shutting down, flattening out, and then, when pushed beyond what she could tolerate, lashing out. I believe she generally did not understand what she had done wrong. She was not in a place where she could organize the linear events of how her actions had affected me, could not process my own reactions, could not handle the emotional, social, and intellectual intricacies being asked of her. She was possibly as hurt and confused and frustrated as I was. I balk to write that. It seems patronizing or dismissive. But I think back on the way she treated me after the accident, her inability to see when I was exhausted, the way she would lash out at me for things I couldn't possibly be responsible for. And I cannot help but believe that. I don't think she understood what the words I was telling her meant or felt the emotional impact they should have drawn. Following this, I spiraled into a black depression, already taxed to breaking by 6 months of caring for Gabrielle. I had no emotional reserves left for this blow. It took me almost 2 years to understand that the hurt was not just heartbreak, but that what I was feeling was grief and loss. Someone had, as I intuited, actually died. I expected that in exchange for my labors, I would get my girlfriend back, or at least a close approximation of her, but I was wrong. It must have been a terrible burden for her, the new her, to carry that expectation. The woman I had known and loved, Gabrielle of the easy smile and quick laugh, Gabrielle of the fingers on the back of my neck as we drove, was dead. She had died the moment she made a careless mistake and turned without signaling, when her head had struck the glass and neurons began to die. We have no place in our culture for this kind of grief. When someone dies, we have a funeral, and everyone comes and holds the people who are left behind and says, "We are so sorry for your loss." This was unavailable to me. I faced this grief alone. Gabrielle was still there. It just wasn't the her I had loved. That woman is gone, and she is never coming back. And we move now to the NFL and the NHL. This is an article published in the New York Times on May 31st, 2019, written by John Branch, titled, "The NFL has been consumed by the concussion issue. Why hasn't the NHL?" The day after Mother's Day was the 8th anniversary of the death of NHL player Derek Bougard. As usual, his mother Joanne spent a quiet day of reflection at home in Regina, Saskatchewan, and continued a tradition of writing a letter to her dead son to be published in the Regina Leader Post. This year's letter lamented a missed call from him the night he died. It detailed life events involving his siblings, nephews, and nieces, who mostly know Uncle Derek from photographs and stories told. The end of her letter, however, was directed as much to the league as it was to Derek. NHL still has a lot of work to do in acknowledging and accepting responsibility for players who have passed and those who are out there with CTE and don't even know it, she wrote, referring to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the degenerative brain disease caused by repetitive blows to the head. Derek Bougard, who had CTE, was 28 and a prized enforcer for the Rangers when he died of an accidental overdose of painkillers and alcohol in 2011. His death and subsequent diagnosis ushered in a period of awareness of the long-term, sometimes fatal, repercussions of brain injuries in hockey. Only football seemed to be more dangerous among major team sports in the United States. With the Stanley Cup Finals underway, Joanne Bougard and a growing group of former players worry that people who've moved on to a stage of acceptance, that the NHL has emerged from its concussion crisis by steadfastly denying that hockey has any responsibility for the brain damage quietly tormenting players and their families. Other factors contribute to the lower sense of urgency around head injuries in the sport compared to the NFL, including hockey's lower profile in the sport's landscape and fewer deaths making headlines. But hockey's strategy of willful denial stands out. During Commissioner Gary Bettman's annual State of the League address before Game 1 of the finals on Monday, neither Bettman nor any of his questioners uttered the words concussion, brain, safety, or CTE. Lawsuits that the Bougards filed against the NHL churned through the courts for years, but were ultimately dismissed, mostly on technicalities over jurisdiction and timing. The NHL has batted away similar lawsuits from other families and accepted no blame in the death of Bougard or others racked by concussions or brain disease. Last year, the NHL settled a case with hundreds of retired players who had sued the league for hiding the dangers of head hits. The $19 million deal was far from the $1 billion settlement the NFL made with former players 5 years previous. There's been a lot going on in the last 8 years, with a lot of hockey players that have died and a lot of others who are suffering, Joanne Bougard said from her home. I don't want people to forget him, and I don't want people to think it's over, that it's all better. It's not. Unlike football, in which the sheer number of CTE cases, more than 100 in the NFL, and the NFL's eventual public admission that there is a correlation between its game and brain disease, forced concussions into the regular conversation around football. Hockey has avoided such a shift. You have this strange cultural disconnect where, presumably, the players can read newspapers and educate themselves on these issues, and their employer, in sharp contrast, doesn't appear to want to educate them and prevent these injuries, said Stephen Casper, a historian of neurosciences and a professor at Clarkson University. Two things seem certain. One, more players will die and be found to have CTE. This is one of those fields where the more you know, the less good the news is, said Ken Dryden, the author and Hall of Fame goaltender. Two, the NHL will deny playing a part. It is what the league has done since the start. After Bougard's death, Bettman was asked by the New York Times about a possible link between hockey and CTE. There isn't a lot of data, and the experts who we talk to, who consult with us, think that it's way premature to be drawing any conclusions at this point, he said in 2011. On May 1st, Bettman sat before a Canadian parliamentary committee investigating concussions in sports. He was asked again about hockey and CTE. I don't believe there has been, based on everything I've been told, and if anybody has information to the contrary, we'd be happy to hear it. Other than some anecdotal evidence, there has not been that conclusive link, Bettman said. Although there are uncertainties surrounding CTE, which only can be positively diagnosed posthumously, it has been linked to dementia-like symptoms, including memory loss, depression, and impulsivity. Scientists remain unsure why some seem to get it and others do not, for example. There are at least 9 publicly known cases of deceased NHL players found to have had CTE, including Bougard, Bob Probert, Steve Montador, and Todd Ewan. Other cases are pending examination. Several other players who never reached the NHL and died before age 40 had the disease, including Andrew Carroll and Kyle Rarup. Last year's deal between the NHL and some former players gave the illusion that the concussion matter had been settled, but the effect was more like hitting a reset button. The few who declined the settlement or never joined the broader case can continue their individual claims. They are expected to receive instructions on how to proceed at a hearing in Minneapolis on June 16th. Among those moving forward is the family of Montador, who played 10 years in the NHL and died in 2015 at age 35. A long-pending lawsuit filed by Montador's estate argues, among other things, that the NHL utterly failed to provide him with crucial medical information on the permanent ramifications of brain trauma. Montador's father, Paul, is eager to resume the fight with the NHL in court. "My son would be alive if it wasn't for the way the NHL handled the concussion issues and had it recognized the impact of concussions and eventually CTE has on its players," Paul Montador said. Montador watched Bettman's recent testimony in Ottawa. Like others, he was disappointed, but not surprised. "Had they handled this differently from the start, he wouldn't have to act like a lawyer," Montador said. "He could act like a human being." The day before Bettman's testimony, Kelly Ewan, the widow of Todd Ewan, filed a lawsuit against the NHL in federal court in California. The complaints include negligence, fraudulent concealment, and wrongful death. Todd Ewan played 11 seasons in the NHL and killed himself in 2015 at age 49, fearing he had CTE. Lily Naz-Hazrati, a neuropathologist with the Canadian Concussion Center, examined Ewan's brain and concluded that he did not have CTE, a surprising revelation later deemed to have been incorrect by others, including scientists at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center. In the nearly 3 years between those competing diagnoses, Hazrati served the NHL as a witness in its litigation, and Bettman used the erroneous Ewan results to argue against links to CTE. He criticized media hype and fear-mongering in a 2016 letter to Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. Critics paint Bettman and the NHL as sports equivalent of tobacco sellers or climate change deniers, purposely clouding issues that few still debate in order to protect their own interests. "It's hard to know what's going to push the NHL to the right side of this," said Chris Nowinski, a co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, which is affiliated with Boston University's CTE Center. "What's clear is that it's not science that's going to convince them." Dryden sees a simple solution. Use rules to eliminate most hits to the head. Concussions will never be fully extinguished, perhaps not in any sport, but Dryden believes any hit to the head, whether accidental or not, whether with a shoulder stick, fist, or elbow, should be penalized. "Football faces an immense challenge. The real answers, they're tough," Dryden said. "In hockey, they aren't. That's the part that is so aggravating." For now, the NHL has tickled the issue with its rule book, penalizing hits that appear to target the head and allowing officials to determine whether they were avoidable or not. "The brain isn't impressed by all these explanations and distinctions," Dryden said. The league still endorses a culture of bare-knuckle fighting. The video game NHL 19 includes it, boosting the energy level of the winner's team. Though fights are in decline, something Bettman applauds while arguing without evidence that some level of fighting is necessary as a thermostat to deter more violent acts. Early in the playoffs this year, the superstar Alex Ovechkin of the defending champion Washington Capitals was involved in a notable one. 2 weeks later, at the parliamentary hearing, Bettman said, "I don't believe there's much we can do to reduce head injuries." He promoted the league's concussion protocols updated regularly, he said, since 2010. The deep contradiction is, if all science is anecdotal, as Mr. Bettman said during his testimony, then why bother having these protocols? Casper said, "What are they for?" Joanne Bugard still waits for someone from the NHL to say that, yes, they could have done more to help stem Derek's onset of CTE symptoms and perhaps save his life. She and her ex-husband Len no longer expect that kind of forthrightness. They did not want to be part of the settlement because they did not want the NHL's money. It's not a money thing, Joanne Bogard said. Just be responsible. Be a leader of the sport. Lastly, from MedPage today, suicide after concussion rare, but risk is higher. And this is written by Judy George and published on November 12, 2018. Though suicide after concussion was rare, patients diagnosed with concussion or mild TBI had double the risk of suicide and a higher risk of suicide attempts and suicidal thoughts than people without brain injuries, reported Michael Frelick, MD, of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health of Boston and currently with the University of Toronto and colleagues in JAMA Neurology. Over 99% of people who have a concussion do not experience a suicide-related event, Frelick told MedPage today. The majority of people feel better within 1 to 2 weeks of experiencing a concussion. For anyone who has symptoms that last longer than this, or for anyone who notices a low mood or suicidal thoughts, it's really important to seek medical attention. The systematic review and meta-analysis examined studies of children and adults that quantified the risk of suicide, suicide attempt, or suicidal ideation after concussion and included both military and non-military personnel. Overall, concussion or mild TBI was associated with a twofold higher risk of suicide. In two studies that provided estimates with a median follow-up of approximately 4 years, 1,664 of 333,118 individuals and 750 of 126,114 individuals diagnosed with concussion or mild TBI died by suicide. And that's an awkward place to leave this, but unfortunately we are out of time for today. So I thank you for allowing me to mangle whatever names I did mangle, and I hope you enjoyed the articles. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well, and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig. And I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.